you look at why judges are granting divorces, the number one reason is irreconcilable differences. And what I usually find, it's a refusal to reconcile rather than truly irreconcilable differences. Mm. Agape love says, I'm going to love my spouse because I made a promise to love my spouse. I'm going to love my spouse in spite of the fact that they're not perfect, because guess what? Neither am I. My contention is, if we have that kind of unconditional sacrificial love, there is no such thing as irreconcilable differences.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Resolutions Podcast, where we like to turn difficult topics into helpful conversations. I'm your host, Chris Campbell. In this episode of the Resolutions Podcast, just in time for Valentine's Day, we welcome Bible teacher, psychotherapist, and founder of Resolutions Counseling, Larry Bell. Larry is the author of a new book, Keeping the Knot Tied, The Covenant of Marriage. In this book, Larry draws from 60 years of marriage to his wife, Dee, his rich Bible knowledge, and his uncanny skill set as a couples counselor. In the book, Larry presents a super simple, super practical model of marriage that is based on a right understanding of biblical love. After reading the book, I immediately reached out to Larry and made plans to bring him on the podcast and talk about the book and his success as a counselor when it comes to encouraging couples and seeing so many marriages restored and strengthened. We think you will really enjoy this conversation. Be sure to stick around after Larry and I wrap up. I'll have some closing thoughts and some updates on future episodes of the Resolutions Podcast. Hey, Larry, welcome to the Resolutions Podcast.
Hey, good morning, Chris. It's great to be with you. I always enjoy our interactions, and I'm glad that you invited me here today.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun. I've got you here to talk specifically about marriage, about covenant marriage. You've written a new book that I really want to make our listeners aware of. But before we get into that, let's cover a little bit of background, your training and so forth. I'm not going to tell your age, but you 72, were one. You were one of the first licensed professional counselors in the state of West Virginia, right?
That's correct.
How did that come about? Tell us.
Well, we started getting notifications and sending out information by snail mail in those days. You know, they were thinking about forming this professional licensing board, and at the time I was working with the state federal rehab program, and it seemed quite apparent to me anyway that this was an inevitability. It was going to happen, and so My thought was, well, if it's going to be a requirement at some point, whether I was continuing to work with a state federal program or open up my own private practice, I just as well get it done, kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So I was in the first group that was certified, and also in 1974, I was the first group that was a certified rehabilitation counselor.
Oh, wow.
Nationally. I was on the first of those, so I'm kind of a dinosaur, I guess. But
no. Well, we'll count you a Jedi master. But I do know obviously firsthand that you had a successful career with West Virginia Rehab, but you also from there sort of went into successfully the private counseling sector. How did that come about? Why did that happen?
Well, I was teaching seminars for Walk Through the Bible Ministries, and one of the seminars that they added when I was 50 years old, well, late 40s, was the prayer of Jabez. And part of that prayer was that he would expand his territory, and that he wanted to do that and get out of his comfort zone and do what God wanted him to do, and ask him to bless that effort. So I got to thinking about that. I was 50 years old. I was working with the state federal program. I had pretty much done all I could do locally. If I was going to advance any more up the career ladder, it would have had to have been at the state level, and I didn't want to go to Charleston.
Yeah.
I just had no interest in moving to Charleston, really. And so I was looking at this prayer, and I was out challenging people to get out of their comfort zone. And then I thought, well, you've been pretty comfortable here with the state. And I could have just stayed with the state and had a full retirement and that kind of thing. But I wasn't satisfied. The bureaucracy was becoming more and more binding. And so I thought, well, I can open up in the January of 2002. I could technically retire early from the state in 2005 because I'd be 55. Mm-hmm. So, and I talked to several people about it. Most people said, well, I said, I'm going to open up a Christian counseling business. I think that's what the Lord wants me to do with the rest of my life. And most of the comments were, well, if you're going to advertise as a Christian counselor and you're going to use and indicate that you're going to use biblical principles and you're going to pray with your clients, you might have a couple clients during the week, but it'd never be a sustainable full-time job.
Yeah.
So I completed all the paperwork in January of 2002 to be registered with insurances and started accepting clients in February. And by May, I was seeing 35 to 40 people a week.
Yeah.
So it was pretty good confirmation. it doesn't take much to hit me up the side of the head, but it was confirmation that I needed to continue that path. So I actually worked two full-time jobs for 2.5 years till I could, I didn't want to abandon my retirement. And so I did that. I worked two full-time jobs for 2.5 years, and then I had to give up one of them, and I gave up the state and never looked back. And God continued to bless Resolutions Counseling in West Virginia. And I was really excited when I moved to Virginia that you had accepted the challenge to complete your counseling degree, and I helped you with your licensure, and you've kept the ball going. And it was kind of a pay it forward deal for me, and it was a blessing to see you to do that. And I know I always told you could be as busy as you wanted to be, and I think you've discovered that.
Yeah, so. This is true. Yeah, and for listeners out there who aren't local, if you just caught that, the Resolutions Podcast is an outreach of Resolutions Counseling Incorporated, and we have the founder on with us today. So I love hearing that backstory. The other thing, too, that you mentioned, Larry, was just your history with Walk Through the Bible. I have always known you to be, and I don't say this lightly, a Bible scholar. I mean, like you, once you got turned on to the Word of God, it just seems like you would dig into it, you know, in ways that benefited so many others, because I think you have a knack for teaching, but I think you have a spiritual gift of teaching. How has, especially Walk Through the Bible, that partnership for so many years, how has that enriched your counseling work and your counseling strategies?
Well, I think back to my conversion in August of 1976. I remember when I was in college my senior year, and I thought, well, one of the professors mentioned that the Bible was the number one bestseller of all time. And I thought, well, since I'm in this intellectual pursuit at Fairmont, I should probably read the Bible. So I picked it up. I think I started with Matthew in a couple of days. That just fizzled out. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. But in August of 1976, when I asked the Lord to forgive me of my sins, to come in my life and make me a new person, then all of a sudden I pick up the Bible, and it just started making incredible sense. And I was from the beginning fascinated with how the original Testament is directly connected to the new, what we would refer to as the New Testament. If you want the Bible that Jesus and the disciples carried, you better go to the 39 original Testament books. So yeah. I was just fascinated, absolutely fascinated and intrigued with the story that God has woven together over these centuries. Mm-hmm. And back in, let's see, dusting off some neurons here, it was in 1978. A friend of mine had gone to a Walk Through the Bible seminar at the Christian Missionary Alliance Church up in Morgantown. And she was in our home Bible study from the time of our conversion. Dee and I had always hosted a home Bible study. And she came to the study and had been to a Walk Through the Bible seminar. And she said, Larry said, you would love this, I think. And also she said, I can see you teaching these. And I went, oh, really? I said, well, I'll check it out. So I checked it out, looked at the information, listened to some of the audios that were available. And I was very interested. So I wrote a letter to, the president of Walk Through the Bible, Bruce Wilkinson, and they invited me to take the training. And that's when I started with Walk Through the Bible and ended up teaching 250 or so 6-hour seminars for them. So it was, and when you're going to go in front of people for 5 hours of teaching and it's basically extemporaneous, I had some bullet notes that I kept by my side in case I needed them, but you absolutely had to be immersed in God's word, God would never have blessed that effort. And God prompted my mind and my memory, and that was a very encouraging time for me because I felt like I was in sync with what God wanted me to do.
That translates into the counseling room too, though, right? I mean, like, how many times are you're trained to help a person with cognitive behavior therapy, the best of behavioral sciences, but also to integrate faith, you know, for you to have this repertoire, this database in the warehouse of your mind that at any time, you know, you working in unison with the Holy Spirit can grab that, pull that to the front and apply it. I mean, right?
No, to me, the scriptures hold the answer for all of life's issues. I can't tell you how many times that I'd be going into a counseling session. It'd be a really rough marital kind of situation or personal situation, individual. And I really just said, Lord, I'm committing this to you. I want you to use me to help these folks. And in the midst of that that prayer, that might happen right during the counseling session, I would be prompted with an idea or a verse that could minister to that. And that's beyond me. Then to see the therapeutic value of that it was just I got confirmations. Probably almost every day in the counseling, in private counseling, that I was doing what I needed to be doing. So I never looked back.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, specifically, Larry, I've invited you to come on the podcast and talk to us about marriage. You've written a book. I've got it right here in my hand, Keeping the Knot Tied, The Covenant of Marriage. So let's give it some context. You are a married man, yes?
Yep. Just December 30th, this in 2022, my bride and I celebrated our 50th anniversary. So that was in this day and age. I think probably it's the exception and not the rule. But I couldn't have been blessed with a better woman. The scripture is clear that he who finds a wife has found a good thing. And I found a very good thing with my bride, Deanna. We've partnered together and been through good times and bad, and always sought the Lord and stayed together.
Yeah. What is it specifically about helping marriages that energizes you?
Well, I look back and I think of God's design for humanity. And the first diagnosis in human history was it's not good for a man to be alone. And so that was the first diagnosis. And then God implemented the first prescription, and that was going to be surgery. And the great physician performs the first surgery, and out of the side of man, he fashions the treatment, the perfect cure, which was he gave Adam his perfect helpmeet in Eve. And the idea to me when I look at that was that Adam was incomplete in and of himself, and Eve was incomplete in and of herself. So the idea was to come together in a marriage relationship and complete one another. And I think that's something that that should be a goal in every marriage. Is we as husbands need to recognize there are strengths that our wives have that we don't have, and there are strengths that we have that that our wife doesn't have, and we need to be aware of those and embrace those, not use that as a source of contention. It should be an embracing kind of thing. So when you look at this and the Hebrew words there are interesting, ish and isha. That's a whole another study. But from Adam was the first human being on planet Earth, and he was formed from the dust of the ground, and God breathed the breath of life in him, and he became history's first human being. And so he was one, and from one became two, and then in the covenant of marriage, the two become one. So it's just a completion of God's design from the beginning, and I think it just gives me a sense of fulfillment to see there isn't a perfect marriage that's ever existed, in my opinion, and we all have struggles in marriage. But the idea is you place your faith in God, you draw close to him individually and together, and then you let God work through you to heal your marriage. And to be part of that healing process, I had a couple came to me many years ago after I first opened in West Virginia, and they had already been divorced. And rekindled a spark there and were dating, and they thought they were getting serious and wanted to do some premarital work. And we went through the principles that I've outlined in this book, and they got back together. And then for years I got Christmas cards with a little baby, and then another one, and that was such a blessing to me. That family got back together, that those the husband and wife got back together, and God blessed them as a family unit with kids that he entrusted to their care. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get any better than that. So,
yeah, those stories like that are just all throughout the book. We're going to provide ways for listeners to get a copy of this book. We can't recommend it enough for themselves, for others, for the churches to have on hand. What you just touched on, I think, is an important distinction of our conversation today, and that is, the cultural understanding of marriage, which by and large is contractual, versus a covenant understanding of marriage. And, specifically, we're talking about not just Judeo-Christian concepts, we're talking about Christian covenant of marriage. And I thought you came up with a really creative way to, even on the cover of the book, to illustrate that. There's a knot tied with three strands together, and a cord of three strands is something that is mentioned in the scriptures, specifically in the Old Testament, but it has everything to do with Christian marriage. So talk to us about that, how you came up with that image there for the cover, the graphic on the cover of your book, Larry.
Well, it is based on Ecclesiastes 4:12 that says a cord of three strands is not easily broken. And the there are so many teaching applications of this, but in regards to the covenant of marriage, I got these three different colors of rope, and the symbolism there is the white strand of rope represents the wife, the blue strand represents the husband, and then the purple, I chose purple because in the original Testament, the color of royalty was purple, and that's the ultimate reference to Yahweh, who has initiated the covenant of marriage. And so I tied them together there, and that picture's on the, like you said, is on the front of the book. And the idea of covenant, though, I think has largely escaped our society. The whole idea for getting married in our culture, whether people want to, it comes from the, if it comes from Genesis, it comes from Moses's words there in Genesis 2, 24 and 25. It says, for this reason, marriage, the husband to be and the wife to be are going to leave their biological and or sociological circumstances, and they're going to enter into the covenant of marriage. And he says, they'll leave, cleave, and become one flesh. And that's based on a series of vows that we exchange for each other. But when people get married, the typical process is you have a pastor or ordained government official that officiates, and on that day, God is using that person to enter the couple into the covenant of marriage. And a covenant is completely different than a contract. A contract, this contract mentality, a contract says, you do this and I do this. And if you don't do this, the contract's over and I'm leaving. And in the book, I've given several references to the brevity of marriages. I mean, some of them last a matter of hours or days. It's incredible the frivolous way that they treat marriage across our culture. And it's to me, and it's infecting the church at a high level too. I mean, some statistics indicate that it's quite possible that half of the marriages that are entered into today will end in divorce at some point. And that has to be, that's very troubling to God who instituted a marriage.
It's tying it back into God in a deep, deep reference that you have, you know, for God. Larry, I want to talk just briefly about one more thing before we get into your work here with the book. I think we need to talk about your writing style a little bit. There is an obvious nod toward Judaism, not just in the principles of marriage, but just in the way that you reverence God. I do want to mention for our younger listeners out there, when you pick this book up and you read through it, they're going to find you referring to Jesus as Yeshua. And this is a messianic reference. They will find, if you are wanting to refer to the sacred name of God, you will find in all caps Yahweh with some vowels missing from that, or all caps God, G-O-D. And I want to tell the texting generation, Larry is not yelling at you in all caps. This is just simply a nod to the sacredness of God's most holy names, and who Jesus is. You know, Old Testament theology really tries to emphasize God's sacredness, his holiness in those writings. So just a courtesy heads up there, for your writing style. Okay, so let's turn our attention to the basics of covenant marriage, the God-ordained union that is designed to model God's love for mankind. Larry, your theory for keeping the knot tied really centers on three basic foundational principles that must be prioritized and shored up. All three of these principles are aspects of love, L-O-V-E, right? And I all caps that in my notes today. But the ancient language of the New Testament portion of the Bible speaks of love in two distinct ways, while the third is implied. And these aspects of love are meant to be very complementary in marriage. And we're going to let you dig into those. We're talking about agape love, phileo, eros. And in your book, you break these three principles of love down into three helpful precepts: leave, cleave, and becoming one. So let's talk first about agape love in marriage, love that allows us to leave our family of origin, make a solemn vow of oneness to another, to a spouse. Give us the overarching principles of this aspect of covenant marriage, Larry. Why is this particular type of love that you lead with in the book so important when you are counseling couples?
Well, one of the concepts that come into my mind when I'm thinking about this is the fact that we as human beings are unique in God's creation. We're the only portion of God's creation who knows there's a God and can knowingly choose to worship him. As much as you love your dog, go home and ask your dog what he thinks about justification, sanctification, glorification. You get a bark, a lick on the cheek, he's good to go. But as we know in the early chapters of Genesis, that initially we were perfect. We were image bearers. But sin changed all that. And so we have a fallen image, and once we're born again, we're in the process of reclaiming that image. And part of that is what happens in the covenant of marriage. And the reason that, first of all, God's ordained it, so we have to come to a conclusion. Do we believe this is something that that God wants us to do? And if it is, then we should follow him and follow his prescription for how it's designed to work. So when you look at the foundation of this, it's kind of hard on a podcast, but it's a triangle, and the triangle is the strongest multi-sided figure known to man. And the base of the triangle will be the component of the leave. I already mentioned the foundation for, we get the idea for marriage in our culture out of Genesis 2, 24 and 25. And it's based on a series of vows that we exchange when we are at the wedding day, and it's interesting. Most couples still use what I would call a traditional format in exchanging vows, but in Deuteronomy 23, 21 to 23, it says this: when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. So in a traditional exchange of vows, or even people who are writing their own vows, they typically include these major components. They promise to love, honor, and cherish one another, and they promise to do that through a series of contrasting statements, through good times and bad, better or worse, sickness and health, richer or poor, forsaking all others. And then the clincher clause that tells us how long it's designed to last is something like till death do us part. And so you enter into the covenant and you exchange these vows on day one. And then over time, people seem to have a continuum that develops in their mind. For better or worse. Well, it's better, and then it's sliding a little bit to the bad side. Worse, it's terrible. And then they have some place on that continuum where they say, well, that's enough, I'm out of here. And that's in each of those components. And that's not what the covenant says. The covenant says that I'm going to remain in this marriage. I'm going to pursue God. I'm going to pray for my spouse. I have three words that are connected together there: leave, commitment, and agape love. And when you leave, relationships change. You typically don't continue to live with your parents. Probably it's not a good idea to do that. You don't have as much time to spend with your siblings. And when you're committed to each other, you should put each other on a special step. And that special step is so unique that from a human standpoint, nobody else is on it. If anybody else tries to get up there, they're going to cause problems. And my challenge to husbands is they should treat their wives as if she's the most important woman on planet Earth. Mm. And my challenge to wives is you should treat your husband as if he's the most important man on planet Earth. Mm. If the husband and wife do that for each other, there's a reciprocity that they can enjoy, and it will bond their relationship and allow it to continue to mature and be secure. And that connects directly into agape love. And agape love is a God love. It's I'm not sure that we can experience or share that at the level that God has on this side of eternity. Hmm. But it's something that I think that with His Spirit empowering us, it's something that we should strive to do. And agape, if you go down to any courthouse in the great state of West Virginia or Virginia, and you look at why judges are granting divorces, the number one reason is irreconcilable differences. And what I usually find, it's a refusal to reconcile rather than truly irreconcilable differences. Mm. And so when you think about this and in the terms of agape love says, I'm going to love my spouse because I made a promise to love my spouse. I'm going to love my spouse because in God's sight, it's the right thing to do. And I'm going to love my spouse in such a way that I'm going to give my spouse every support, encouragement, and challenge to be the best spouse that they can be. And I'm going to model that behavior myself by being the best spouse that I can be. And also, I'm going to love my spouse and fight it, in spite of the fact that they're not perfect, because guess what? Neither am I. And my contention is, if we have this kind of love, which is a love described by Paul that Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. If we have that kind of unconditional sacrificial love, there is no such thing as irreconcilable differences. So,
yeah, well said. And you know, again, I think that the notion of unconditional love founded in grace and truth, I mean, agape is a higher way. It's a higher level of understanding that naturally comes to us, but with Christ in the center of it, we can learn, we can grow in it. There's a lot of hope there. The second aspect of love that that you champion in this book, and it has to be understood and cultivated, is phileo. And that type of love is commonly thought of as brotherly love, phileo love. Larry, take us deeper into that. In a Christian covenant marriage, you liken this to intimacy in your book. Tell us more.
Well, like in the base of the triangle, it's leave, commitment, and agape, and then in the intimacy side, it's cleave, intimacy, and phileo. But it's one thing that I almost always do, probably always do, when I have a couple come, and I put the first session is I put this model together to make sure they're comfortable with it, and they want to work within that framework. And then if they're not comfortable with it, they probably need to go somewhere else, because that's the direction I'm going to take, is to try to strengthen these three sides of the triangle. But I always put the guy on the spot, and I'll say, notice here I've written, I start out in a diagram, and I have commitment, intimacy, and passion. And I say, you notice I've separated intimacy from passion. And I'll say, what's the first word that comes to your mind when I say intimacy in the context of marriage? 90% of the guys, when I ask them what intimacy is, the first word that comes to their mind is sex. 90%. Now, the sexual part of the relationship, let me just kind of go there for a minute, and then we can do what you want later on that. But the sexual part of the relationship that I'll refer to as passion, that's the sexual nature, the sexual aspect of the relationship. God thought sex was a great idea. Passion was a great idea. He's the one that invented it. But it's to be shared in the safety, sanctity, and security of the marriage covenant. And it should be pleasurable for both and frequent enough that neither stray from that. But that's over on the passionate side. So then we get back to after I've clarified that, because I think it's very important to clarify that from the beginning, particularly for guys to do that. So then I come back and go over some of the aspects of intimacy, which cleave, intimacy, and phileo, which is, like you said, brotherly love. In the area of intimacy, I kind of go back and get a little history from a couple. When did they start dating? How did they meet? How long did they date? And then if they've had children, I'll ask them, say, okay, your first child was born, and did you have, they both of them had the privilege of being there, and how long did it take the medical staff to clean your newborn up and get that newborn baby back in your hands? And they say, well, just as quickly as possible. And I said, well, why do they do that? And they say, well, most of them come up with the bonding. Yeah. And the medical staff wanted the parents to verbally affirm their love for that child and physically affirm that love for their child. They wanted to tell the child that he's loved or she's loved. And they want to touch, to hold, to caress, and physically affirm. Well, that bonding creates two very important principles, that the child is significant and secure. And so that's what happens during the dating time, or should happen during the dating time. We are attracted to the other person. We verbally express, "Hey, I like you. I like you a lot. Let's be exclusive with each other. I love you." And then you enter into the covenant of marriage, and you go through a progress procession where you hold hands, you embrace, you kiss, you become comfortable with each other's physical presence, and enter into the covenant of marriage. Well, what happens over time is some of those very good things that brought us together in a bonding process, we don't pay attention to. We don't continue to nurture and to grow. And if that happens, then over time, what happens? You start questioning, am I significant to my spouse? He's not saying anything to me. Am I secure in this relationship? We don't have any physical touch. And this physical touch that is specifically for intimacy, not for passion. Mm-hmm. It's a caring touch. It's a comforting touch. Mm-hmm. It's I'm there for you touch. It doesn't automatically lead to passion. And that's one struggle that guys have, man, if my wife gives me a hug, you know, we're headed to the bedroom. Mm-hmm. So they kind of have to work on their mentality on that. But communication in the area of intimacy is important. Couples should be talking about finances, budgeting. The top two issues that the couples generally have when they come to see me for marital counseling are parenting issues and financial issues. Those are the top two. And if you're struggling in those two, then passion always suffers. That's one thing I've found. There's a lot of things I don't know, but here's one thing I know for sure. If intimacy is not right in the marriage, passion always suffers. Nobody comes in and says, "Hey, we're struggling. We're arguing all the time. We're having financial problems. We're not disciplining the kids. We don't have we're not on the same sheet of paper for discipline." But our sex life is great. Nobody says that. There's mm-hmm. a direct connection there. Mm-hmm. So communication is essential. My challenge to couples is they should be best friends. I think the physical touch I alluded to a little bit earlier there was extremely important. And this physical touch is an affirming touch. Mm-hmm. It's in the area of intimacy, not passion. And also, I think it's important to invest time with each other, continue to date. During the dating time, when we're trying to win the other person's affection and attention, we generally don't have problems putting each other on the calendar. But what happens when we get married? Well, the busyness of life takes over. And in our culture, I see this a lot. You have a good dating experience. You enter into the covenant of marriage. And then both the husband and wife are working. And in our culture, that's sometimes a necessity. But work is a time drain. Then you throw kids into the mix. Mm-hmm. And kids are a time drain. And what I find is a lot of couples that the only common time together that they have as husband and wife is with the kids. Mm-hmm. Well, the kids become the glue that hold the marriage together. And then sometimes after 25, 27 years, however long it takes for the last kid to fledge. Mm-hmm. When the last kid fledges, we sociologically call that the empty nest. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, a lot of times it's the empty marriage. And I see people abandoning the covenant of marriage when the glue, the kids, left because they never continued to date mm-hmm. the husband and wife. And I think that's a critical mistake. And I think they need to it's never too late to adjust that. The longer you wait, the more difficult it is. But I think it's important to invest the time together. I think it's important to exchange tokens of affection. Remember your birthdays and anniversaries and Christmas and Valentine's Day. But when you think about that, that's only a handful of days. And I'm not suggesting that it needs to happen every day, but it should. During the dating time, we have a much more tendency to be spontaneous and romantic and things like that. And I try to practice what I preach. I play on a tennis contract on Monday nights. And after I leave, I drive by Kroger's, and Kroger's has these beautiful flowers. And I buy my flowers for my wife every week to make sure they're fresh. And I know she appreciates that. She doesn't expect that. Has nothing to do with a birthday or anything. So it's on the intimacy side where you develop trust and honor and respect for each other, that's the intimacy side. Did you have any questions about that?
I think you break that down just in such an exceptional way. And just a point of reference, a couple of things that I'm thinking of here is. My wife and I, we were friends for 7 years before we ever dated. And we dated other people. you know, during that time, we were, both of us would tell you, we weren't walking with the Lord at all, you know, during those years. But the friendship aspect of what we had between us was really so unique. We didn't realize at the time, we couldn't have told you, hey, we have an intimate friendship, because we didn't think of the word intimacy in the way that you just explained it. But I remember, you know, when I finally, you know, asked her out, you know, one of her points of reluctancy going out with me is, what if we don't make a good couple and we ruin our friendship? And I just remember going, I think our friendship at this point is too deep to ever ruin, you know. And I didn't really know what I was saying, but I think there's just some truth to that. And conversely, you know, I can't tell you the amount of times that people who are very sincere and loyal find themselves compromised in marital fidelity because the intimacy aspect of their relationship has waned, and all it takes is for another person to touch them in a way that signifies phileo, what you were just talking about. Just a simple touch on the forearm, or a simple hug, or what, or hands just happen to brush each other. And I think it underscores, you know, this deep need of love that we all have and is built for this covenant marriage. But if you neglect that aspect of it, you know, it could get you in a lot of trouble. Fair or unfair for me to say that?
No, it's exactly right. Now, to me, that's where spiritual warfare and the enemy attacks at the most inopportune times, if you will, opportune for him, but not opportune for the couple. But for example, if the marriage becomes stagnant and you're not communicating well, you're not sharing physical touch, you're not verbally affirming your love, or you're not doing it at a level that's healthy, then that's where the enemy attacks and says, hey, you're not getting any kind of intimacy, physical affirmation from your husband. Well, here's somebody that will probably do that for you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys have learned that technique. Unfortunately, they become predators. They learn if they become intimate and meet the intimacy needs of a woman, she'll be willing to share the passion. And that's the same thing, for example, with husbands. If they don't feel like their passionate needs are being met, and then all of a sudden a coworker looks really good, you know, and then you start a conversation, and then that leads down to a road that ends in adultery. So, I think you're spot on there. I think that's the main tactic that the enemy uses to destroy marriages. And it's been very effective.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, to be on alert is something that is more than just, are we focused on cultivating a covenant marriage, but are we also, you know, cognizant of building up a good firewall, you know, around our marriage? Finally, we get to the most, what I think is the most common perception, and dare I say, the most misunderstood aspect of love, and that is eros. Larry, I appreciate your candor on a subject that many Christians will sidestep. It's unfortunate that historically Christians feel like they are on thin ice with God if they speak of the physical aspect of a covenant marriage union. The silence in and from the church on this matter has likely made it easy for misunderstanding, confusion, deception. And like in most endeavors, when the initiators are ignorant, we tend to put the cart before the horse or follow the path of least resistance, shall we say. Yeah. This is especially true with the modern approach to sexual expression here in the U.S., but eros, or becoming one flesh, is a divine design that God has had in mind since the beginning, since before the very beginning, the very establishment of holy matrimony. So let's take a few minutes and unpack the aspect of physical love in marriage.
Sure. When I think about this and my own personal development, I was kind of a late bloomer. If you would have talked to me, and that wasn't true just for me, but in general in our culture, if you would have talked to me in sexual terms when I was in the sixth grade, you just as well have been speaking a foreign language, because I would have had no clue what you were talking about. But if parents and the church aren't addressing sexual issues to sixth graders now, they're making a big mistake, because with the internet, the advent of the internet and the availability of sexual materials, and particularly pornographic, these young kids are exposed to the adult topic of sexuality way too early in their life. And many times it steals their youth. I challenge parents regularly. I just had a couple parents a couple weeks ago that came in to see me, and they were devastated because of their what they found on the phone of their ninth grader. And they hadn't been monitoring the phone. They hadn't been monitoring the computer. And they had just been trusting. That to me is something you have to do. You need to know where your kids are in regards to sexuality. So when I think about this, it kind of boils down to the way that our Creator has programmed us to bond. And I think in general, and you can show me exceptions to either of these, but in general, like if you went to a community pool and you watched and you observed for a couple hours the young boys, what are they doing? They're running. They're, even though they're not supposed to, it can be a badge of honor to get a timeout from the lifeguard. They're mm-hmm. jumping in the pool. They're diving off the diving board. They're wrestling around. If there's a ball, they're throwing it. And in fact, if a young girl comes into their territory, she's generally not welcome. She's going to have to be one tough little customer to put up with their harassment. But these young boys are programmed by our Creator to bond physically. All right. Mm-hmm. Young girls, on the other hand, in general, and like I said, you can show me exceptions to this, young girls, they have a different perspective. They might get in the pool and swim around, but if they have something to do that night, they'll be careful not to mess up their hair. They get out of the pool. They help each other with their lotion, and then they do something really fascinating. They'll form a little circle. They'll take their towels or their chairs, and they'll have their own social group, and it's like most of the time it's in a circle. And what are they doing? They're talking, they're gossiping, they're giggling with each other. If one of them was traumatized by one of these young punks, they're helping her through that life-changing experience. There's probably no group on planet Earth more opinionated than a 13-year-old girl.
Be careful.
I know. Send the emails to Chris, not to me. But highly opinionated, highly verbal. And if they're there any length of time, the topic of their conversation will mature well beyond their years. They'll talk about what it is to date, and maybe what their husband might do for a living. And they'll talk about kids. Some of them will have an idea how many kids they want to have, and others will have picked out names, things that would never enter the mind of a 12-year-old boy. All right. And these 12-year-old girls go to the bathroom. Two's a minimum. The pack is better. 12-year-old boy's got to go. He's out and back. He doesn't need any social support. Right. And if he's too busy, he might take care of business in the pool. It's kind of why I avoid public pools. But little girls are programmed to bond emotionally. So down through this tunnel of time, little boys who grow up to be husbands and are programmed to bond physically have no problem appreciating and enjoying at a high level the passionate part of the relationship. I've never had one guy in the hundreds of couples that I've worked with came into my office and said he hated sex. Not one. Hmm. I'll just leave that there. And young ladies, on the other hand, who are programmed to bond emotionally, have more experience by nature in the intimacy side. Hmm. So when you think about this in completing one another, men have to recognize that they have intimacy needs too, that are not directly connected to passion, and they need to be willing to invest the time to meet their wife's intimacy needs. If they do that, they'll share the celebration of their marriage, which is passion. And you look at the Greek word there for eros. Eros is mentioned one time in the scripture, but if you look at the Song of Solomon, all right, Solomon, interesting guy. When he wrote his very best song, the Song of Solomon. This is a sensual song. Rabbis often will not let their rabbinic students read this book until they're 30.
Right.
But you can't go through that book and not think in terms of passion in the context of marriage. Mm-hmm. And that it also speaks to the design that God had. It was one man to be totally enthralled and in love and committed to one woman. And he was committed to the Shulamite bride above all the others. That shows you God's design. And he puts the stamp of approval on the passionate part of a relationship to be shared in the safety, sanctity, and security of the marriage covenant. And when I think of eros is where we get English words like erotic or erotica from. And there's nothing wrong with that terminology when it's used in the context that God intended. Hmm. But you go home tonight and you turn on the TV, that kind of sensuality is selling jewelry and hamburgers and cars and clothing. And I'm pretty sure God's not too happy about that, you know, the way it's been misused. And then we have the whole misappropriation of sexuality in the context of pornography. And that pornography actually rewires the human mind. And it's incredibly powerful. And the large majority of people who have pornography problems are men. And they get hooked on this. And I'll tell you what, it's with the availability of pornographic sites, there are literally hundreds of thousands of pornographic sites. You can even type in something innocent that you're searching on the internet and come up, and all of a sudden you get this crazy response that's pornographically connected. But pornography has ruined and is ruining a lot of marriages. And there's one principle there that I want to share. I asked the guys, okay, are you involved in pornography? Yeah, and they admit it. And we talk about the frequency, when it started, and things like that. And I'll say, well, when you're involved in pornography, are you cheating on your wife? And they go, most of them say, no, I look, but I didn't touch. And I ask the wives, and I've done a running survey over the years, 100% of the wives believe that their husband has been unfaithful to them when they catch him on pornography.
So true.
It's a huge perception problem, and I think that's part of the way that the enemy tries to make that a subtle kind of thing, and makes a differentiation in a man's mind. But it's a problem for the wives, and I think it should be a problem for the men. And I look at this overall. I address this in the book, but you look scripturally, there are five primary reasons for marriage that I think that God has developed marriage for, so that we can have a pattern for intimacy with another person that's like no other, our very best friends. It's for plenitude, completing one another. It's a divinely created partnership. And then passion, sharing the sexual aspect. And one of the primary reasons that we need to do that is for procreation. God blesses a marriage with kids, and his desire is for godly seed to have our faith perpetuated through the generation. And then it's an ultimate picture of Christ being the bridegroom and the church being the bride. So the mystery is very deep there when you get into Ephesians 5, and Paul uses that analogy. But the center of the triangle, I put there very clearly, is Yahweh. That's the covenant name of God that he gave to Moses in Exodus 3 when he said, "Who shall I say sent me to Pharaoh and the people?" He said, "Yahweh," which means I am. And then Yeshua, who is Yahweh in the flesh. Yeshua is the Old Testament equivalent of Joshua, which means God is salvation or God saves. Mm-hmm. So when I think of the name of Yeshua, it would be Yeshua ben Yahweh, Jesus, the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's the center of our marriage, and we worship together, we pray together, we serve together, then there's nothing that we can't get through together.
Yeah, that was so deep, everything that you just walked us through there. And I would just encourage listeners to don't lightly pass over this. Back up, listen to it again. Of course, get a copy of this book. But just, you know, I think a few of those steps, the majority of those steps are, they're so beneficial. Not the steps, but just like, why is marriage, you know, how has it been established as a covenant? What are the points here that we can see in it? It's so beneficial, not just to the husband and wife, but the way that overflows into culture and blesses culture. But, you know, the sacred mystery of marriage, where somehow in Christian covenant marriage, there is a greater opportunity for God to manifest in undeniable ways. That sounds like a far-fetched idea, but you've been married 50 years. This year, my parents, they're both alive, they hit 60 years.
Wow, that's awesome.
And you know, here's what I will tell you. Those two, over the years, have learned, you know, the principles of covenant marriage. And over 60 years, if you don't kill each other, you will synchronize. Right? And I will tell you, it is uncanny the way that for years they had just an encouragement ministry in their local church, no official place of leadership, but people who needed prayer would line up to talk to them and have prayer, you know, after a church service. Yeah. As I am a power of attorney for them, and I'm making sure that they're taken care of health wise. I can't tell you how many times, a physician assistant, a nurse, you know, an administrator, even a doctor or a surgeon will just open up to them and share something that they can't believe. And I'm standing there, I was like, I can't believe this person is telling this private information. And my parents immediately will bless them, something fully encouraging, and we'll pray for them. And then they hear back that the prayers have been answered, or, you know, they used to eat out a lot more, and just to quickly learn a server's story and then to pray for them. And then you go into Bob Evans the next time and hear there's an answered prayer. And why am I telling you this? I'm saying this to say there is a supernatural manifestation of a holy marriage, holy matrimony that is sanctified by God in the ways that the scriptures outline. And you do it beautifully here with commitment, intimacy, passion, leave, cleave, one flesh. The addendum of this book, Larry, is you've got some observations, some case studies here of biblical marriages. But, you know, just as a way of wrapping up, how about giving us another example of just a personal success story that you were privileged to be an encourager in, a part of? Any story in particular come to mind that our listeners out there would find some great encouragement with?
Well, the one that comes to mind is it's kind of a warning. I've got so many examples. I loved studying when I was studying for and doing the research for this book. Winston Churchill and his wife were walking down the streets of London, and she paused for a moment, walked across the street, and engaged in a conversation with this street sweeper. And when she returned, Winston said, "Well, like, who was that?" And said, "Well, this is a young man that years ago we had an interest in each other." And he goes, "Well," said, "you could have been the wife of a street sweeper." He says, "No, Winston, if I'd have married him, he'd have been prime minister." So I love that story. And when I think of marriage, two things I'll share with you there in closing. Your mom and dad have been great examples for us. I respect them highly, and they've impacted a lot of lives. And when I think about them and what they've done, I often challenge couples who are in the midst of turmoil, and they've got kids at home. And the covenant of marriage is a generational covenant that can be for blessing or for cursing. And I tell these folks all the time that your son is looking at you And he's determining what it means to be a husband and what it means to be a dad. And he's likely to replicate that to the woman that he chooses to marry. And the same thing for your daughter. Or they're looking at you as a wife and a mom, and they're going to make choices, life choices, very impactful choices on how they see you treating each other. And I hear this way too often that, well, my dad was like this, and that's the way I am, and it's negative. And or my mom was like this, and that's the way I am. The good news in for us as believers is we don't have to be held hostage to the baggage of the past. We don't have to do that. We can choose. We're a new creation in Christ, and if we seek God and we draw, and I encourage couples all the time, draw close to God individually, draw close to God as a couple, and then serve together. And if you do that, God will meet you there. Is it okay if I share one on warning?
Yeah, yeah.
This is one of my most interesting scenarios that I've ever had. I had this lady that came to see me, and she was absolutely convinced that her husband was being unfaithful. Absolutely convinced. But she was checking the phone. She was doing everything that I would have recommended she had done. And he was really clever about how he handled things. But one evening, they came home from work. They shared a meal together, and he said he had to go pick up some supplies, like from Lowe's. And so he said it'd take about an hour or so. So he takes the dog with him. All right. And he goes and he picks up his girlfriend, and they go out on some country road there in the hollow, and they're enjoying their time together. And the so he wants to stay longer. So he calls on the cell phone, and he lies to his wife and says, well, the supplies are taking longer. I'll be another hour. And he hangs up. She hears the dial tone. He throws the phone in the back seat, and they get involved sexually in the front seat. The dog's going crazy. The dog's paw hit redial. He answers the phone and hears it all. He came home and she said, where have you been? He lied. And she finally said, I heard it all. You need to come clean. And she asked him how long it had been going on. It had been going on for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
One thing that I've found is if a woman has this, most of the time, if a woman has this gnawing feeling that her husband's being unfaithful, she's normally right. Mm. There's something going on. Mm. And when I think of that, I think of Numbers 32:23, be sure your sins will find you out. Mm-hmm. You know, and God's watching over our marriages. He wants to bless our marriages. And if we don't stabilize marriage, we're going to have problems.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today is Larry Bell. He's a licensed psychotherapist, Bible teacher, and author of Keeping the Knot Tied, The Covenant of Marriage. Larry, where can our listeners get a copy of your book and find out more about your work and ministry?
The book is available on Amazon. That's probably the easiest place to get it. It's also on Barnes & Noble and Xulon, Xulon Press. But I think the easiest way is to go through Amazon. And if anybody would want to contact me, I would be glad to respond, like to emails. It would be lbresolutions@yahoo.com.
We'll have all the right links in our show notes. With your permission, Larry, we'll lift that the diagram of the triangle, and we'll also have that there so people can easily reference that as they're listening to you. But hey, thanks so much, not just for being on the show today. Thank you for being just the mentor you've been for me through the years, a friend, the encourager that you are. It's been super fun to have you on the podcast.
Well, hopefully we'll do it again sometime on another topic.
Well, that's a wrap on another episode of the Resolutions Podcast. We hope you found this particular episode to be thought-provoking and helpful. For more information on Larry Bell's new book and his ministry, be sure to check out the show notes. And if you're wondering, what has happened to Michael Gumm, our longtime co-host? Don't fret. Michael will soon be returning to the show. In the weeks ahead, we will be creating new resolutions rundowns where Michael and I will be looking at real-time mental health issues and talking about a variety of topics in a way that is uniquely psychological, theological, and spiritual. We are also planning upcoming shows with more noted authors and guests who will be discussing issues like adoption and foster care, overcoming porn addiction, finding your people, developing meaningful relationships, and what we've learned about cannabis use as it is legalized. I also want to mention that we are putting together an episode that addresses the highs and lows of being single in the 2020s. It's good to remember on the backside of an episode about marriage that single adults are often one of the most overlooked segments of modern culture here in the U.S. And if that's you, we want you to know that we see you. So stay tuned. We have some encouragement planned for you. As always, thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and give us a positive rating on your platform of choice. The Resolutions Podcast is a free resource. We desire to serve as many people as possible, and you can do your part by sharing our podcast with others on your social media posts, by subscribing, and of course, giving us positive ratings. If you're reluctant to do so, hit us up and let us know what we can do better. So until next time, I'm Chris Campbell. Let's be sure to meet up again at our next episode drop.